because he didn't need Dad's name. All he needed was a way to lay a trap. Summer, where's your mom?
On the river.
Do you know how to drive?
Come on, I'm 14.
That's not what I asked. She realizes I'm serious.
Sure, Billy. I mean, I'm not supposed to drive without a grown-up in the car, but I know how.
Where can we get a vehicle? I say, any vehicle.
You think it's an ambush, don't you?
Maybe I'm wrong again. I hope I'm wrong. But what if Baxter figured out his wife was talking to Dad, and now he's using her to set Dad up? From Summer's expression, I can tell she's had the same chilling thought. Her eyes flicker, but her voice holds steady.
I've got a knucklehead cousin who lives over on M Street.
What kind of knucklehead? I ask.
The kind that always leaves his keys in his car.
19. The cousin owns a towed gray Subaru with 199,009 miles on the odometer. I'm sure it came off the assembly line before Summer or I was born.
She says, I learned to drive on a tractor, like half the kids in Montana.
But you've also driven a car before, right?
More than you, I bet.
She's undoubtedly right. My entire road experience is one tense afternoon with my mom, going 10 miles an hour back and forth in an empty church parking lot. Not exactly good training for mountain highways. As predicted, the keys to the Subaru are in the ignition. Summer says her cousin bartends at night and sleeps all day. She sticks a note in the mailbox saying she's borrowing the car.
Hop in, Billy Big Stick.
Please tell me the seatbelts work. Although Summer's tall enough to see over the steering wheel, she still looks too young to be in that seat. Her solution is a wide floppy hat and a pair of Lil's wraparound shades. It turns out she's a pretty good driver. We brought water, bear spray, snack bars, and the plastic whistle that Dad gave Summer to take on hikes. She offered to carry the binoculars, which means I've got extra space in my backpack. I plan to use it. I say I need to pick up two things for our trip. Summer asks what. I tell her. Her response,
are you nuts?
The first item we can find at the drugstore. The second will require some luck. Later, heading south on Highway 89, I get a call from my mother freaking out at the Denver airport, where she and Belinda have a layover.
I cannot believe you got off that plane! You are so permanently grounded!
That's fair.
Don't you dare be sarcastic with me!
I'm not, Mom. Whatever you decide to do is okay.
Where's your father? Put him on the phone right this minute.
You're gonna miss your connection, I say. Text me when you and Belinda get home tonight. Bye. After ending the call, I hear myself let out a sigh. Summer laughs.
How long are you grounded for?
Only until I turn 25. You want me to Google directions to Tom Minor?
I know how to get there. She says,
hey, I broke up with Davy on the phone last night.
Want to know why?
I'm thinking, not really.
He was getting bored with me, I could tell. And I was semi-bored with him.
Summer, one thing you're definitely not is boring.
It's all good, no pain.
The radio in her cousin's car is broken, so I can't turn up any music to end the boyfriend discussion. My only escape is changing the subject. Do you think he'll ever move back to the reservation? I ask.
Maybe after college, she says. Why don't you look more surprised?
Because I'm not.
I want to be a doctor. How about you?
No clue. I can't think that far ahead.
Billy, I can totally see you as a veterinarian. A reptile veterinarian.
Right, I say. Can't wait to run that one by Mom. Midday traffic is steady on the main road through Paradise Valley, mostly tourists streaming to Yellowstone National Park. Summer is careful to drive below the speed limit, which
which means we're getting passed constantly by rental cars, minivans, trucks pulling drift boats, even a Winnebago. But she's smart to go easy on the gas pedal. If we got stopped by the police, we'd never be able to BS our way out of this. Two underage kids cruising along in a vehicle that doesn't belong to them. Summer has kept one eye on the rearview mirror ever since leaving the Livingston city limits. She relaxes a little once we reach the turnoff to the Tom Minor Basin. Not many cops up here.
I hope this is the right place, Billy.
If Baxter's setting a trap for Dad, it makes sense to do it here. He knows the area from the last time. When Dennis buzzed that big old grizzly, the drone master himself, I say.
Too bad we never got to see the video.
My father erased the file from the quadcopter's SD card. He was afraid someone who didn't know a poacher was on the scene might think he was dive-bombing the bear just for a sick thrill. Summer slows down to show me a young elk browsing in the emerald green alfalfa, hundreds of feet below us. The crop is being watered by the rancher's pump station on the bank of a silvery creek. I ask Summer if Lil knows that Dad went chasing after Lincoln Baxter. She says,
he didn't have the you-know-whats to tell her. He waited until she left this morning before he took off.
Heading uphill toward the campground, we spot my father's red Chevy King cab. It's parked on the shoulder, not far from where we found it the last time. None of the tires are flat, and the fenders show no fresh bullet holes. Summer and I agree that's encouraging. This bumpy dirt road would be Baxter's only way in or out, but we don't encounter any other vehicles until we pull into the campground. There's a chrome RV occupied by two friendly couples from Canada, a Honda sedan carrying college kids getting ready for a hike, and a rust-chewed Jeep Wagoneer that appears to be the permanent residence of a snowy-bearded geezer with four scrawny dogs, all yappers. Summer does like a 7-point turn, motors back down the road, and parks behind Dad's pickup. She taps her knuckles on the steering wheel and says,
"Where the heck is Baxter?"
"Maybe he's on horseback." "Horses get hauled in by trailers, Billy. You see any trailers?" "Then maybe he's not here. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe he was never coming." I just now thought of this. What if the real plan wasn't to ambush Dad? What if the real plan was to send him on a wild goose chase?
"But why would Baxter do that?" Summer asks.
"So he could sneak off somewhere else and shoot a bear, drone free. See, he makes his wife think he's hunting up here again, knowing she'll rat him out to Dad, and then Dad'll come looking for him.
Only meanwhile," Summer interjects, "Baxter is miles and miles away, over in the Tetons or the Beartooths, killing a grizzly.
The ultimate revenge, right?"
"Another solid theory, Billy Big Stick. But so was the last one.
I'll keep trying till I get it right." One thing we forgot to pack was rain jackets. I don't know where the storm came from. In a matter of minutes, the afternoon sky changed from sunny to dark, angry purple clouds spilling over the mountain ridges. You're not supposed to stand near a tall tree during a lightning storm, but Summer and I find ourselves stuck in the middle of a towering forest. In a pounding downpour, we crouch low on the trail, flinching whenever a lightning bolt strikes close by. The car is more than a mile away, so there's no sense making a run for it. We're already soaked to the skin. This is my second serious Montana thunderstorm, and I'm not sure if I'm safer here in the woods than I was on that rock beside the river. One time I got caught in weather like this with Mom and Belinda down in Everglades City. It blew in on a Sunday morning while we were out in the neighbor's boat watching the bald eagle nest. The stupid outboard engine wouldn't start, so all three of us lay down in the bottom of the boat, pressing our cheeks against the aluminum hull. It seemed like the lightning and thunder went on for hours, but the worst of it probably lasted only 10 minutes. Still, we had to keep bailing rainwater out of the skiff Mom using her coffee mug while Belinda and I scooped the best we could with empty Gatorade bottles. That was the first time I'd been close enough to experience the sound of the sky being ripped like a sheet in that frozen split second right before lightning strikes, and I totally admit being scared out of my freaking mind, though I also remember wondering if the Baldies were all right, hunkered in their ragged treetop nest. Then the rain quit, the wind died, and the clouds rolled away. We looked up and saw Mom's eagles circling overhead, scouting for bait fish, as if the storm was no big deal, a minor inconvenience. But at this particular moment, it's hard to stay patient and calm, because Summer and I smell smoke. A blinding spear of lightning struck a dead lodgepole pine not far down the trail, and the tree is smoldering in the rain. It probably won't catch fire, but I'd still rather be somewhere else. Summer isn't delighted about our situation either. The temperature has dropped sharply, and we're getting cold. She says, "Well, this truly sucks." What do bears do in weather like this? Party, I guess. They're bears. A drenched raccoon walks out of the woods, shakes itself like a weary dog, sniffs the smoky air, and ambles away. "He wouldn't even look at us," I say.
"Because we're so pitiful, Billy."
Summer's teeth are chattering. I move closer to warm her up. All she's wearing is a soccer jersey, hiking shorts, and neon green cross trainers. She wrings her hair and knots it into a soggy ponytail.
"Maybe this is payback," she mumbles, "for me breaking up with Davy.
Or for me lying to my mom."
"The list goes on,"
she says, and we both manage to laugh. Soon the thunder stops and the rain slacks to a drizzle. We stand up, dripping and stiff-jointed. The dirt trail is now pure mud, and the tracks we'd been following are all gone. They were impressions made by a man's hiking boots. I wear a size 10.5, and my shoe fit easily inside one of the tracks. Summer said Dad's a size 12. We decide to resume walking the same way the boot prints had been pointing, a logical plan, until we come to a three-way fork in the trail.
"Now what?" I say to Summer.
"Don't look at me. Just 'cause I'm an Indian doesn't mean I'm good at this stuff."
We crawl around on our knees, searching for a broken twig or any tiny clue that might reveal which of the paths my father chose.
"Major confession," says Summer as she combs the wet grass and pine needles. "I was actually glad to get off the res, Billy. It can be a dark, sad place. Some of our people, they drink too much and do bad drugs. You look in their eyes, it's like they just gave up. And some of them are kids my age."
For her, this is a brutal subject, and as usual, I'm not sure what to say.
"You want to stay part of this amazing culture," she goes on, "but you're afraid the bad stuff might drag you down so far you'll never climb out. Truth is, I'm not sorry we moved away. I'm sorry for the reasons I feel that way, especially when somebody tells me and Mom how lucky we are to be here and not there."
"Summer, it's not like you totally disconnected from the tribe."
"Yeah, I know. We go back on weekends and hang with family, but that's not the same as living it day and night. And sometimes, like right now, it's hard to feel like a real Native American. Not when a white boy knows more about tracking than I do.
Hey, who found those panther prints in the Everglades? You."
"That was dumb luck."
"No, it wasn't," I say. I'm right, too, because moments later I hear her exclaim,
"Billy, check this out."
She's pointing to a bright blue bean-sized beetle, lifeless in the muck on the middle of the three paths. The beetle did not die of natural causes. It's been squashed almost flat. Summer says,
"Something heavy landed on that little dude."
"Yeah, like a size 12 foot."
Farther along, we come across a broken branch, still green. Dangling from the sharp end is a thread of khaki fabric, confirming that a human has passed this way. We hurry on, trying to keep our voices low. A patch of blue above the treetops signals the storm is officially over, though the branches are still shedding raindrops. The path leads us out of the woods to a wide, rocky meadow that looks familiar to me. I'm almost certain it's the same place where Dad's drone dropped his first note, the same place I spotted that Mama Grizzly and her cubs. Summer takes out the binoculars. Something in the distance caught her attention. "Bad news, Billy," she says. I grab the binoculars from her hands and have a look. At the far end of the meadow, a raft of large, dark birds is circling. They are definitely not eagles. "I wonder what they're looking at," Summer murmurs uneasily. "Whatever it is," I say, "it's probably dead." Because that's what buzzards hunt. 20. Deep in Grizz Country, Summer and I don't want to draw attention by crossing the open fields. Instead, we take the longer route toward the buzzards by following the edge of the trees. I start chanting, "Whoa, bear! Hey, bear! Don't eat me, bear!" Summer pokes me in the back and says, "Knock it off. But you told me to make noise so we don't surprise him. Can you please come up with something not so lame?" "Like what?" "I don't know, Billy. Sing a song. That's what lots of hikers do." "No way. I'd sound terrible." Summer doesn't sound terrible. She has a really nice voice. I can't understand the words, but it doesn't matter. She says it's a push dance song from Crow social gatherings. She only remembers the first part, which she sings over and over. The melody is high and piercing, but the vibe sort of fits our situation. There's no danger of startling a grizzly now. They will definitely hear us coming. As we hurry along the timberline, the sun pops out and a warm breeze starts to blow. Classic Montana weather. One minute you're shivering, the next minute you're sweating. As the meadow lights up, Summer and I notice something that wasn't visible in the first gray aftermath of the storm. A large military-style tarpaulin in prairie camo. The tarp has been pinned down to conceal something bulky beneath it. Leaving the cover of the pines, we venture out for a closer look. In the distance, the buzzards keep circling. Both Summer and I fear the same awful possibility, though neither of us dares to say it aloud. Meanwhile, the tarp is flapping like a ship's sail in the gusty wind. We start yanking out the stakes until one side billows upward, revealing a small red helicopter. It's a two-seater with folding rotors. My latest theory was wrong, obviously. Lincoln Baxter didn't send my dad on a wild goose chase. He's right here. He also didn't lie on his profile about being a pilot. "This is not good," Summer says, folding her arms. "I know, I know. Just give me a minute. We gotta hurry, Billy." I step into the chopper and take the pilot seat. It's like sitting in a glass bubble. Randomly, I start turning dials and flipping levers, anything to stall Baxter's escape. I've got something else that might work, too, the second item we picked up on the way to Tom Minor. As I unzip my backpack, I notice Summer striding away, crossing the meadow, straight toward the circling buzzards. I yell for her to come back, but she can't hear me. The cockpit glass is too thick. As soon as I hop out of the helicopter, she takes off running. I'm faster. That's not a knock, just a fact. Even though I tackle her as gently as possible, it's not exactly a soft landing. She cusses and kicks, but I'm not letting go until she settles down. And I totally get why she's so frantic. "It's not safe out here," I whisper into her ear. "We need to get back in those trees, like now." "No, But what if that's Dennis out there on the ground under those birds? He could be...
Stop, Summer. Don't even think it.
Once in a while, I wonder about my dad's mother and father, the grandparents I never got to meet. And it sounds weird, but I try to imagine the phone call Dad got on the day they died. How do you deliver such horrible news? What words do you choose? It was a car accident, Dennis. They swerved to miss a turtle. Okay, that's not funny, I would have said, if it had been me. Now what's the real reason you're calling? The truth is when you're young, it's impossible to think of your mom or dad dying all of a sudden. In fact, you try not to think about them dying ever. Sometimes, though, reality grabs you by the throat. This one kid at school, his mother has cancer. Right now, she's doing okay, but whenever she goes for a doctor's appointment, this kid gets sick to his stomach the whole day, terrified they might find something bad. I mean, he's literally throwing up until she comes home. He's a tough dude, by the way. Tougher than me, for sure. Belinda and I are lucky because Mom's always been super healthy. Still, I worry about other things, like her Uber job, driving around all alone with total strangers in the car. There are lots of jerks in this world, which isn't exactly front page news. Sometimes Mom isn't as careful as she ought to be. But I'd never worried about Dad that way, because he was gone from our lives so early. As they say, out of sight, out of mind. If he'd died back then, I'm not sure how sad I would have felt. It's hard to miss somebody you barely remember. I'd miss him now, though. Summer and I just found his gear, hat, sunglasses, backpack, bear spray, and drone. Most of the stuff is scattered down the slope of a small ravine. We see the satellite phone smashed to pieces at the base of an aspen tree. At the bottom of the ravine is a small creek where the barrel of Dad's submerged shotgun glints in the shallows. I take out my plastic whistle, thinking the high note will travel farther than a human voice. Our hope is that Dad's hiding somewhere nearby. Even if he can't signal back, at least he'll know we're out here searching for him. My mouth is dry as chalk, but somehow I get a few sharp bursts out of the whistle. Summer clambers down the rain-slicked bank to retrieve the case holding the quadcopter. It seems to be undamaged. We kneel at the edge of the trees and use the binoculars to spy once more on the creepy fleet of buzzards. This time we're close enough to see what's grabbed their attention. Two deer are lying on the ground, and I'm pretty sure they didn't drop dead from heart attacks. It looks like Lincoln Baxter is up to his old poacher tricks, baiting the bears. "Why don't those birds land?" Summer says. "What are they afraid of?" Good question. The buzzards should be down by now, devouring those carcasses before other forest scavengers arrive. "Maybe they see something we can't see," I say. If they do, it's probably not Lincoln Baxter. He would be well hidden somewhere, waiting and watching through the magnifying scope of his rifle. "Hey, Billy."
"What?"
"Something moved. One of those deer."
"Maybe it's still alive."
That might explain why the buzzards are waiting to land. They prefer their meals to be thoroughly expired. Summer hands over the binoculars.
"Check it out," she whispers hoarsely. "Only one of those things is a deer."
Oh, no.
The other body on the ground belongs to my father. Now I see his hiking boots.
"You're sure he moved?" I ask.
"Positive, Billy."
100% sure, because to me he looks... quiet.
"I'm 1,000% sure he moved."
There's a rope around his ankles.
"I saw that," says Summer. "Which, why tie up a person who's dead?"
Excellent point. So Dad's alive. That's the good news.
The bad news is we can't run out there to help him without putting ourselves squarely in Baxter's view. I snap open the case that holds the drone. Summer says, I thought you didn't know how to fly that thing. Now's a great time to learn. Time is the problem, Billy. We don't have any. The wind's dropping. This could actually work. I set the quadcopter on the flattest piece of ground I can find. The four propellers attach easily. Then I program my phone to control the video camera, again, easier than I was expecting. Just click on the app Dad installed for me. After that, snap the phone into the cradle on the remote control unit, and we're ready for liftoff. Well, almost. The remote has dual joysticks, one for thrust and one for altitude. From watching Dad launch the drone, I remember him toggling both switches at the same time, though in opposing directions. That requires nimble coordination and probably more than a few practice flights. The first time I try it, the quadcopter rises to a measly altitude of 3 feet, maybe 4, before suddenly streaking straight into the branches of a choke cherry tree. Luckily, there's no harm to the aircraft. The twin joysticks would be easier to use if I were a hardcore gamer, but I'm not. I don't even own an Xbox. On my next attempt, the drone goes higher, but then loses power and spirals downward, bouncing on impact. This time, one of the blades snaps. I scramble to replace it with a spare from the kit. So it's a crash course, Summer says. Literally. You want to try? Just hurry up, Billy. A few miraculous minutes later, the quadcopter is staying airborne. The camera works too, feeding live flight video that we're watching on my phone. Now let's buzz those buzzards, I say. They aren't as aggressive as eagles. Confronted by the speedy aircraft, the birds break formation and scatter high into the thermals. I toggle back on the thrust, easing the drone into a stationary position. It's a wobbly hover, though, so the view of the scene below is a bit unsteady. One extremely dead deer and one extremely uncomfortable Dennis Dickens. A strip of gray tape covers Dad's mouth, and he's completely trussed with ropes. The knots binding his ankles and wrists are pegged to the ground with the same type of stakes that held down the helicopter's tarp. Finally, we know Lincoln Baxter's true plan. He never intended to kill my father himself. The grizzly that comes to eat the dead deer will do that. Then Baxter will kill the grizzly. Summer and I feel sick and helpless. With no cell service for miles, our phones are useless. There's no way to call for help. Dad wriggles against the ropes to let us know he sees the quadcopter. I want to go get him, Summer pleads, her voice cracking. Not yet. Walking straight into Baxter's rifle sights would be crazy. Even if he didn't try to kill us, a warning shot could be deadly if it ricocheted the wrong way. You can't tell me what to do, Billy! No, but I can chase you down and drag you back here, I said. It's too dangerous out there, Summer. Let's try something else, okay? The drone's GPS isn't working, so I steer manually. I must be getting better. The aircraft returns to us as if it were on a wire, settling softly in the same spot it took off from. Inside the case is a small claw-like attachment, the same kind of device Dad used in this very meadow to deliver his first message to me. After connecting the claw to the underside of the drone, I click on my phone app to enable the grab and release functions. Summer says, Fine, now what? This is what. I pull it from my pocket.
Whoa!
Summer's face lights up. A kid named Chin gave it to me.
B-A-D. Is that you, Billy?
We'll see. I untie one shoe, peel off my sock, and slide the heavy pocket knife inside. After hanging the sock on the mechanical claw, I launch the drone toward my father. And yes, I know his hands are tied. He'll figure it out. Mr. Government Spy. When it stops, the quadcopter's altitude is 23 feet, slightly higher than a two-story house. Dad lies absolutely still, his eyes locked on the hovering drone. I touch the button. The claw's talons open. The knife drops and hits my father right between the legs.
Ouch,
says Summer. The sock helped cushion the blow. I honestly think so. Still, Dad's eyes are clenched tight and the veins in his neck are bulging. It's probably a good thing there's no audio. On the plus side, the impact caused Dad to jerk so violently that he yanked the top stake out of the dirt. His hands remain tied at the wrists, but at least he'll be able to grab the sock, shake out the knife, and open it. And he'd better move fast. I move the toggles to turn the drone around. Summer and I are glued to the video feed. Our last screen glimpse of Dad shows him fumbling with the sock. I wonder if Lincoln Baxter is seeing the same thing through his rifle scope. With any luck, he's looking elsewhere, scanning the meadow and timber ridges in search of his long-awaited prize, which the quadcopter spies first. The unmistakable image flashes on my phone, striking us cold with dread. Summer cries, "Make the drone go back!" Easier said than done for a rookie pilot, an incredibly nervous rookie pilot. The aircraft is sluggish to respond. Summer raises the binoculars. "Can you see it?" I ask. "You mean her. How far from Dad?" 100 yards, max," Summer says. "Maybe less. No, definitely less." This is what they call a worst-case scenario. After what feels like an eternity, I finally coax the quadcopter into a stable position high above the grizzly, which is standing tall on two legs and sniffing the air. It's got to be the same bear I thought I saw, and obviously did see, the first time I was here. Her two cubs stop wrestling in the goldenrods to peer up at the sky. They hear the high-pitched hum of the mini spycraft. On the camera, the baby bears look like chocolate fur balls, while Mama on her hind legs is a brawny, unhuggable tree trunk. Suddenly, she drops to all fours and starts loping toward the poacher's target zone, double-baited with a lifeless deer and a roped-down human.
"You know what to do," Summer says. "Make it fast."
Using a puny little drone to scare a big-ass alpha predator requires precise flying skills and flawless reflexes. My father is pro at this, but he's currently not available to instruct me. Cautiously, I thumb the thrust lever to begin the pursuit. As quick-footed as grizzlies are, the quadcopter easily keeps pace. I drop the altitude until the drone is flying at eye level with the running bear. She's trying to figure out whether the airborne invader is just a noisy pest or a serious threat. At once, she slams on the brakes, her cubs crashing clumsily into her rear end. It's impossible to stop the drone that fast, so I fumble with the joysticks, trying to navigate a crash-free U-turn. Summer reports that the big grizzly is very close to the spot where Dad is tied down. "She's standing up again, Billy. Not a happy mom." I struggle to keep the quadcopter positioned between my father and the bear family. The drone is fluttering like a dizzy duck, but eventually I get it stopped in exactly the right place, floating near enough to bother the mama grizzly, but far enough to avoid those ham-sized killer paws. Even though I'm viewing her through a tiny camera lens, the expression in the bear's eyes makes the hair rise on my neck. She's deciding whether to attack or run away with the cubs. Running away is what we want her to do. The faster and farther, the better. For the moment, it's a standoff between a mountainous beast and a pint-sized flying machine. Standing beside me, still watching through the binoculars, Summer asks, "Is that you beeping?" It's the remote control.
What does that mean?
I'm not positive, I say, but I think it means the battery's low.
The battery in the drone? The one that makes it fly?
Okay, we need to stay chill. Without a proper pilot lesson, I'm unaware of all the high-tech features on Dad's new quadcopter. Apparently, it came with advanced software that automatically guides it back to the takeoff location when it needs recharging. This ultra-smart program is very convenient, unless the GPS doesn't work because there's no cell tower nearby, and an angry 400-pound carnivore is standing between the aircraft and the spot where you want it to land.
What's going on? Summer says. Does that crazy drone have a death wish?
It doesn't know where to go. No GPS signal.
Then you be the GPS, Billy. Steer it around the bear.
Once again, I grasp at the toggles, but there's no time to change the flight direction. The quadcopter is way too close to the grizzly, and the grizzly is way too quick. Helplessly, I watch the fateful collision on my phone. The final image is a ferocious flash of teeth. Then the screen goes blank.
She got it! Summer blurts. One bite!
I snatch the binoculars to see for myself. The mother grizzly is gnawing on the mangled drone. With a snarl, she spits out the pieces and rakes a claw through the pile of cracked plastic and shredded wires. Summer exhales in despair.
She's not leaving, is she?
Nope.
Billy?
I know, I know. The bear and her cubs are still hungry, and they smell dinner. Catered by Lincoln Chumley Baxter IV. 21. The animals march toward my captive father's location. All that Summer and I can do is try to spook them. Frantically, we clap, yell, even whoop, trying to make the scariest sounds two medium-sized humans can make. The grizzlies act the opposite of scared. They don't even bother to glance our way. After chomping the noisy mutant bumblebee, or whatever she thought the drone was, the mama bear seems calm and confident as she leads her offspring to the wilderness version of a longhorn steakhouse. If deer is the main course, Dad will be dessert. Or the other way around. It seems impossible that he hasn't gotten the pocket knife open by now, yet I still see him wriggling on the ground. For me and Summer to dash out there and distract the grizzlies would be a suicide mission. She's ready to try, but I won't let her. None of us, including my father, would get out of here alive, leaving Mom and Lil broken-hearted forever. Despite the horror I'm feeling, I can't put down the binoculars. Tears are puddling in the eye cups. The knife drop should have worked. I swear, it was the smart play, our only play.
Whoa, bear,
I whisper to myself. Summer says,
look, she's up again.
Only a few strides from the deer carcass, the mother bear has halted and risen to her full height. Behind her, the cubs are standing too. So, finally, is Dad. They're staring at him, I say in a shaky voice.
Obviously.
What in the world is he doing?
I have no clue, says Summer.
Everybody who lives in Montana knows the drill if you cross paths with a wild grizzly. Take out your bear spray, just in case. Don't run. Stay as motionless as possible. Speak in a low, non-threatening tone. Avoid eye contact. Back away slowly. Dad's can of bear spray is in the ravine, so scratch that off the list. And he's definitely not standing still. Is that some kind of crow dance? I ask Summer.
No, she says. That's a crazy white guy trying not to get eaten. draped with dangling lengths of rope, Dad's arms are upraised and swaying like palm trees in a breeze. The mother bear seems totally puzzled. Who wouldn't be? Summer says, I get it now. He's trying to make himself look big. I remember reading about an old hiker who always carries an umbrella when traveling through wild country. If he encounters a grizzly, the first thing he does is open the umbrella above his head. He says it gives him the shape of a much larger animal and discourages the bear from charging. The umbrella trick isn't often recommended by wilderness pros, but this must be Dad's version, using the ropes he cut off with Chin's knife. From here, he looks like a tall, shaggy, capital Y. The mama grizzly has never faced such a peculiar creature, and she's not sure how to react. A ringing gunshot makes her decision easy. She wheels around and gallops toward the woods, the cubs at her heels. A second shot follows, pinging off a rock. Summer says, Where did he go? I lost him! Me too. Instead of watching the bear's retreat, I should have been watching Dad.
Look over there, Billy! More to the right! No, over there!
Where? The binoculars are shaking in my hands.
How far?
Between us and that bare split pine on the far side of the meadow.
Now I see him!
My father is moving away from the grizzlies and gunfire, though not as rapidly as he should.
Could he possibly run any slower?
Summer groans. That's not running, I say. That's limping. And at the very instant Dad comes into perfect focus, he disappears into the high timber.
You're probably thinking, now would be a good time to go for help. The bears are long gone, and it should be easy for my father to locate a hiding place where Lincoln Baxter can't find him. The sensible thing for me and Summer to do is hurry back to the road, jump in her cousin's car, and race to the nearest ranch that has a working phone. Except for one thing. Dad was limping, which means he's hurt. The question is, how badly? Did he twist an ankle, which is no big deal, or did he get hit by one of the poacher's bullets? This time, when Summer says we should go after him, I say, You're right. First, we backtrack to the ravine and retrieve Dad's gear. I gather up his backpack, sunglasses, hat, and bear spray. Summer wades into the creek for the shotgun.
Broken!
She calls up to me.
Then leave it!
Walking through the thick pines and underbrush is a slog because there's no trail to follow. I blow the plastic whistle, hoping Dad's close enough to hear. Unfortunately for us, someone else is closer. We don't discover this until he steps in front of us and says,
Stop right there, both of you.
I've never had a real gun pointed at me before. Judging by Summer's expression, this is her first time too.
Who are you?
Barks Lincoln Chumley Baxter the Fourth. He's got the full camo thing going on, gloves, a hood, even face paint. He looks furious and jumpy at the same time, gnawing an unlit cigar. Two more are visible in his vest pocket. The rifle he's carrying is a big one, but I'm sure they all look big when they're aimed in your direction. Summer and I respond with first names only.
What the hell are you doing out here?
Baxter demands. Hiking is my answer.
Don't lie to me, Billy, or whatever your real name is.
We've messed up his scheme big time. Now he doesn't know what to do with us.
We came to find my father, I say. That guy you tried to feed to the bears, Summer adds fearlessly.
Baxter looks angry enough to shoot us right here and now. His bleached white teeth are bared, giving him the appearance of a rabid poodle. He doesn't pull the trigger, though. Some tiny corner of his tiny macho brain is telling him that poaching humans is way more serious than poaching grizzlies or panthers.
Mrs. Baxter doesn't think much of your hobby, I say.
It's not that I'm trying to piss him off. I just want him to realize that we know his name, and that we've also got a pipeline to his wife. If anything bad happens to us, she'll know who did it. When you're in the middle of negotiating, this is known as leverage.
You've got no idea what you're talking about, Baxter says, without much steam.
Summer waggles a finger at him.
Please don't point your gun at us. I'm a Crow Indian, FYI.
Which is the perfect line, because it gives Baxter one more thing to worry about.
Trust me, Summer says. You don't want the whole Crow Nation mad at you.
She's guessing that his view of Native Americans comes from the movies. She wants him to think there's an arrow in his future, and sure enough, he lowers the rifle.
I wasn't gonna shoot anybody, he says, unless they gave me no choice.
I tell him we don't have any weapons.
How do I know you're not lying?
Right. We're gonna attack you with what, a stale granola bar?
If you don't believe us, says Summer, check our backpacks. We drop all three of them, mine, hers, and Dad's, on the ground. Baxter empties the contents and shrugs.
Fine. Whatever.
He stomps both of our cell phones and kicks them into the bushes. One thing he does not do is order us to empty our pockets.
So your plan was to let the grizzly kill my dad, I say. Then you'd shoot the bear and tell the game wardens...
What, exactly?
That it was justified, of course, says Baxter. It's completely legal to take a grizzly in self-defense. First the bear attacks your old man, then he charges after me. That was my story, and they would have believed it, too.
But you shot a deer for bait, and it's not even hunting season. How are you going to explain that?
The poacher allows himself a smile. There's not a single bullet in that deer. It got hit by a car on Highway 89, and it was dead when I found it. Now, how it got all the way out here for the bears to eat, who knows?
Summer cuts in. We saw your helicopter, Mr. Baxter. Mystery solved. There's something I need to ask the guy before all this ends. Why shoot a grizzly bear? I say. What's the point of killing an animal that's disappearing from the planet?
That's easy. It's the challenge. They're humongous and dangerous and, best of all, very rare.
Baxter clearly has no shame.
There's barely 700 grizzlies left in all of Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho. Once it's legal to hunt 'em, they'll get smart and super hard to find. That's why I'm out here now. Before they catch on.
You're serious, aren't you?
I am, boy, and you're too young to be judging me.
Summer clasps my arm, but hey, I'm not crazy enough to throw a punch at a person holding a loaded gun. She says, Mr. Baxter, the bear you shot at today had two cubs.
They'd be fine on their own, honey. They're tough little hombres.
Summer tightens her grip. Now she's the one who looks like she wants to jump him.
Besides, he adds, I was only trying to save your old man's life. Which I did, by the way.
But you'd tied him to the ground, I say.
No, here's what really happened. I was sightseeing in my personal helicopter, minding my own business, when I spotted this dumbass hiker all by himself in Grizz Country. Then I saw a huge bear start following him, so I landed the chopper, grabbed my gun, and fired two rounds to scare off that vicious beast. That's my new official story. And if you or your daddy says otherwise, I'll tell the game wardens he brought his drone out here to spy on the grizzlies so he could shoot one himself. I'll even show 'em the creek where he dropped his gun, and guess what? It'll be my word against his.
And ours, too.
Summer bristles. Baxter laughs acidly.
Kids'll always lie to protect their father. You don't think the authorities know that? Like I said, it would be your daddy's word against mine. a well-respected businessman from an old, well-respected family. What they call a pillar of society. That's me. An edgy lull follows. Songbirds high in the branches remind me where we are, in the midst of a mountain forest after a hard rain. The crisp air smells sweet enough to drink. Golden rays of sunlight slant through gaps in the treetops. A place so peaceful and perfect is totally wasted on a jerk like Baxter. If you two are smart, he says, you'll have a long talk with your old man. Explain the situation. Make him understand that the best thing to do is forget he ever knew my name. Now, speaking of yours truly, I am out of here. Then, as if somebody flipped a switch, the birds quit singing. Lincoln Baxter halts in mid-stride, turns back slowly, and pulls his gun close to his chest. Hear that? He whispers. How could we not? Something heavy is advancing toward us through the woods. It's not trying to be sneaky either, which indicates a total lack of fear. Branches snap, bushes thrash, and dead logs crack under the weight of whatever is coming. No way, that's a deer, Baxter murmurs anxiously, or even an elk. It's not a moose either, says Summer. Moose are quiet. I'd say we've narrowed the list. As the animal draws closer, it lets loose a deep chorus of nerve-racking sounds, huffing, snorting, grunting, growling. I try to sing the go-away bear chant, but the words die in my throat. Summer's fingernails are digging into my arm. Crouched nearby, Baxter seems to have forgotten we're here. As the oncoming uproar grows louder, the saplings and bushes begin to part in front of us. Baxter raises his rifle to his shoulder while I reach for the pocket where I put Dad's can of bear spray. At the same moment Baxter takes aim at the fierce commotion, I take aim too, blasting the poacher point blank in the face. The main ingredient in bear spray is called capsaicin. It comes from hot cayenne peppers. This isn't necessary information if you live a quiet, normal life, but I did a little research. I wanted to be sure I'd be carrying enough firepower. Propelled by an aerosol burst, capsaicin doesn't blind predators, but it makes their eyes and mouth burn like the devil. A face full of pepper mist is so painful that a charging grizzly often wheels around and flees, which is the whole point. Bear spray won't blind humans either, but the experience is pure agony. Lincoln Baxter crumples to the ground, screaming. The gun drops from his hands. With a growl and a huff, Dad lurches out of a thicket. He shakes off a few loose ropes and looks down at the writhing poacher. Good shot, Billy, he says. But how'd you know it was me coming at you? Wild guess. You mean lucky guess. Summer gasps.
You're bleeding!
Yes, I am, Dad replies. He kneels beside the yowling, scarlet-faced Baxter, seizes him by the camo hood, and says, Aren't you sorry you didn't take up golf? Then he calmly dumps the bullets from Baxter's rifle and hurls them downhill into a thorny thicket.
We should get you to a doctor, I say. Don't you think?
22. It was Baxter's second shot that bounced off a rock and struck Dad in the thigh. He plugged the wound with a knotted bandana to slow the bleeding. The team at the emergency room said that might have saved his life. We had rushed Dad from the Tom Minor Basin to a fire station near the Pine Creek Lodge. Summer drove faster than the speed limit. The paramedics didn't ask to see her license. They loaded Dad into an ambulance and raced straight to Bozeman. Mom flew in yesterday to make sure I was okay. I got a 30-second hug and a 30-minute lecture.
Afterward, she agreed to come to the hospital, where my father spent the rest of the afternoon apologizing to her and Lil. The poacher's bullet tore through some muscles and nicked his thigh bone, but Dad's going to be all right. A surgeon cut him open and fixed him up. The sheriff's department is keeping the crumpled slug for evidence. Belinda has been texting me from Florida. She wants a photo of Dad in the hospital bed. So he poses for her, giving a half-hearted thumbs up. His room has an amazing view of the Bridger Mountains, but he's still in a lousy mood, mad at himself for getting captured by Lincoln Baxter in the woods.
Unbelievable, he grumbles. I thought I was smarter than that.
Lil and Mom restrained themselves from stating the obvious.
What did Baxter tell you? I asked Dad.
That he was sick and tired of me hassling him with the drone. While he was tying me up, he said, "You like grizzly bears so much, now you're going to see how much they like you."
The rope marks on his wrists are still pink and raw.
"The cops will catch up with him soon," Lil says.
Dad stares listlessly out the window.
"Maybe. Maybe not."
"Of course they will," says Mom.
Summer kisses his forehead. "You're still the craziest white man I ever saw." Dad's roommate is a wheat farmer who broke his hip when an ATV flipped on top of him. He's not getting much rest because Dad has lots of visitors. Sheriff's deputies have been at the hospital 2 days in a row, along with officers from the Forest Service. Dad told them everything about his secret drone missions to stop Lincoln Baxter's poaching. I don't think they're ready to give him a medal, but they're acting like they believe him, at least for now. Dad is well aware that Baxter will spout a totally different story if they find him. Summer and I were questioned, too. They wanted to know everything Baxter said while he held us at gunpoint. One of the Forest Service officers took us to an empty hospital room and spread a topographical map of the Tom Minor Basin on the bed.
"Where was the last place you saw this man?" he asked.
I pointed to the ravine and said, "Afterward, he probably ran down to the creek to wash the bear spray off his face."
"We've already searched that area. Twice."
"Then maybe he's gone. All you've got to do is find that red helicopter."
"Oh, we've got the helicopter. It was tied down in the same place you saw it. Right there."
The officer tapped his pen on a black X that had been drawn on the map.
"The door of the chopper was wide open," he added, "but there is no trace of Mr. Baxter."
Summer acted surprised. "So he could still be out there somewhere?"
"Possibly. We assumed he'd walk out to the dirt road and then hitchhike to the main highway, but his family in California hasn't heard from him."
Summer said, "I don't get why he didn't use the helicopter to escape."
"We believe something scared him out of the cockpit."
"Like what?"
"Like a rattlesnake," said the officer, "on the pilot's seat."
"Whoa!"
Summer widened her eyes. "Was the snake alive?"
"Oh, extremely," the officer capped his pen. "Coiled up inside a pillowcase. Very weird."
My stepsister was trying her hardest not to look at me. "Maybe Baxter's a snake collector," I said.
"No, his wife told us he's terrified of them."
The officer rolled up the map.
"Want to hear something else? The rattler's mouth was taped shut."
"Really?" I replied. "Now that is weird." I know, I said I wouldn't do it again, but I did. What I put on the snake's jaws wasn't regular tape. It was a Steri-Strip, a sticky piece of medical fabric designed to protect stitches or small wounds. They're available at any pharmacy, including the Western Drugstore in Livingston, Montana, where Summer and I stopped on our way to Tom Minor. Unlike ordinary surgical tape, Steri-Strips fall off by themselves after about 10 days. That's exactly what I needed, because I didn't want the rattler to be crawling around too long with its mouth held shut. Usually they go about 2 weeks between meals. Again, no normal person would need to know that. You might be wondering, how do you get a rattlesnake to hold still long enough so you can tape its mouth? I'm not telling. It's too dangerous. And I mean insanely, ridiculously dangerous. I'll never do it again. This time, I'm serious. And if you're foolish enough